I could feel the small, urgent growls he was making in his throat, and felt another one, much louder, rising in mine. My shift was wadded high around my waist, and my bare buttocks smacked rhythmically against the roughened brick, but I felt no pain at all. I gripped him by the shoulders and held on. His hand skimmed my thigh, pushing at the drifts of linen that threatened to come between us. I remembered vividly those hands in the darkness and bucked convulsively. "Look!" His breath came hot in my ear. "Look down! Watch while I take you! Watch, damn you!" His hand pressed my neck, bending my head forward to look down in the dimness, past the folds of sheltering fabric to the naked fact of my possession. I arched my back and then collapsed, biting the shoulder of his coat to make no noise. His mouth was on my neck and fastened tight as he shuddered against me. We lay tangled together in the straw, watching daylight creep through the half-open door across the red brick floor of the stable. My heart was still thumping in my ears, blood tingling through skin and temples, thighs and fingers. But I felt somehow detached from such sensations, as though they were happening to someone else. I felt unreal and slightly shocked. My cheek lay flat against his chest. Moving my eyes slightly, I could see the fading red flush of his skin in the open neck of his shirt, and the coarse curly hairs so deep and auburn that they looked nearly black in the shadowed light. A pulse was throbbing in the hollow of his throat, no more than an inch from my hand. I wanted to lay my fingers on it, feel his heartbeat echo in my blood. I felt oddly shy, though, as though such a gesture were too intimate to contemplate, which was completely ridiculous in view of what we had just done with, and to, each other. I did move my index finger just a bit, so that my fingertip brushed the tiny three-cornered scar on his throat, a faded white knot, pale against his bronzed skin. There was a slight catch in the rhythm of his breathing, but he didn't move. His arm was round me, his hand splayed on the small of my back. 2 breaths, 3. And then the faint pressure of a fingertip against my spine. We lay silent, breathing lightly, both concentrated on the delicate acknowledgement of our connection, but didn't speak or move, slightly embarrassed with the return of reason at what we'd just done. The sound of voices coming toward the stable galvanized me into motion, though. I sat up abruptly, yanked my shift up over my shoulders, and began to brush straw from my hair. Jamie rolled up onto his knees, his back to me, and began hastily to tuck in his shirt tail. The voices outside stopped abruptly, and we both froze. There was a brief, charged silence, and then the sound of footsteps delicately retreating. I let out the breath I had been holding, feeling my racing heart begin to slow. The stable was filled with the rustlings and whickers of the horses who had heard the voices and footsteps too. They were getting hungry. "So you won," I said to Jamie's back. My voice sounded strange to me, as though I hadn't used it in a long time. "I promised you I would." He spoke softly, head bent as he rearranged the folds of his plaid. I stood up, feeling mildly dizzy, and leaned against the wall to keep my balance as I brushed sand and straw from my feet. The rough feel of the bricks behind me was a vivid reminder, and I spread my hands out against them, bracing myself against the rush of recalled sensation. "Are you all right, Sassenach?" He turned his head sharply to look up at me, sensing my movement. "Yes." "Yes," I repeated. "Fine. Just... I'm fine. And you?" He looked pale and scruffy, his face stubbled and hollow with strain, eyes smudged black from a long and sleepless night. He met my eyes for a moment, then glanced away. A hint of colour showed on his cheekbones, and he swallowed audibly. He began, then stopped. He got to his feet and stood before me. His formal queue had come undone, and the tails of his hair splayed over his shoulder, glimmering redly as the bar of light from the door lit him.
"You dinna hate me?"
he asked abruptly. Taken by surprise, I laughed.
"No," I said. "Do you think I should?"
His mouth twitched a little, and he rubbed his knuckles across it, scraping on the stubble of his beard.
"Well, maybe so," he said. "But I'm glad if you don't."
He took my hands gently in his own, his thumb rubbing lightly across the interlaced pattern of my silver ring. His hands were cold, chilled by the dawn. "Why ever do you think I might hate you?" I asked.
"Because of the rings, you mean?" "Granted, I would have been upset and furious with him had he lost either one. Since he hadn't. Of course, he had caused me to worry all night about where he was and what he was doing, to say nothing of sneaking into my room and making improper advances to my feet. Perhaps I ought to be annoyed with him after all." "Well, starting with that," he said dryly, "I haven't let my pride get the better of me in some time. But I couldn't seem to stop myself, what with wee Philip Wiley preening about smirking at your breasts and..."
"He was?" I hadn't noticed that part.
"He was," Jamie said, glowering momentarily at the thought.
"Then he dismissed Philip Wiley, returning to the catalogue of his own sins."
"And then dragging you out of the house in your shift, and going after you like a ravening beast."
He gently touched my neck, where I could still feel the tingling soreness of a bite mark.
"Oh. Well, I quite like that part, actually." "You did?"
His eyes flicked wide and blue in momentary startlement.
"Yes. Though I rather think I have bruises on my bottom." "Oh."
He looked down, apparently abashed, though the corner of his mouth twitched slightly.
"I'm sorry for that. When I'd finished, at the whist, I mean, I couldn't think of anything but finding you, Sassenach. I went up and down that stair a dozen times, going to your door and back away again."
"Oh, you did?" I was pleased to hear this, as it seemed to increase the odds that he had, in fact, been my midnight visitor. He picked up a hank of my rumpled hair and ran his fingers gently through it.
"I kent I couldn't sleep, and thought, well, I shall go out and walk in the night for a time. And I would, but then I should find myself again outside your room, not knowing how I'd come there, but only trying to think how I might get to you. Trying to will you to come out to me, I suppose."
"Well, that explained my dreams of wild stallions," I thought. The place where he had bitten my neck throbbed slightly. And where had he brought me? A stable. King of Ireland, forsooth. He squeezed my hands lightly.
"I thought the force of my wanting must wake you, surely.
And then you did come."
He stopped, looking at me with eyes gone soft and dark.
"Christ, Clare, you were so beautiful, there on the stair with your hair down and the shadow of your body with the light behind you."
He shook his head slowly.
"I did think I should die if I didn't have you," he said softly, "just then."
I reached up to stroke his face, his beard a soft bristle on my palm.
"Wouldn't want you to die," I whispered,
tucking back a lock of hair behind his ear. We smiled at each other then. But whatever else we might have said was interrupted by a loud whinny from one of the horses, followed by stamping noises. We were interfering with their breakfast. I dropped my hand, and Jamie bent to pick up his coat, which lay half buried in the straw. He didn't lose his balance as he bent, but I saw him wince as the blood went suddenly to his head. "Did you have a terrible lot to drink last night?" I asked, recognizing the symptoms. He straightened up with a small grunt of amusement.
"Aye, quarts," he said ruefully.
you can tell.
A person with much less experience than I could have told at a distance of roughly half a mile. Putting aside the more obvious indications of recent intoxication, he smelled like a distillery. It didn't impair your card playing, evidently, I said, being tactful. Or was Philip Wiley similarly affected? He looked surprised and slightly affronted.
You didn't think I'd get besotted whilst I was playing, do you? And with your rings at stake? No, that was after. MacDonald fetched a bottle of champagne and another of whisky, and insisted that we must celebrate our winnings in proper style.
MacDonald? Donald MacDonald? He was playing with you?
Aye. He and I were partnered against Wiley and Stanhope.
He shook the coat, sending bits of straw flying.
I couldn't see what sort of soldier he was, but the man's a fine hand at the whist, to be sure.
Mention of the words fine hand reminded me. He'd come to the door of my room, he said. He hadn't mentioned coming in. Had he, and been too far gone between liquor and longing to recall doing it? Had I, dazed with dreams of equine lust, imagined the whole thing? Surely not, I thought, but shook off the sense of vague disquiet engendered by the memory, in favour of another word from his remark. You said winnings. In the stress of the moment, it had only seemed important that he had kept my rings. But it occurred to me belatedly that those were only his stake. What did you take off Philip Wiley? I asked, laughing. His embroidered coat buttons, or his silver shoe buckles? His face had an odd expression as he glanced at me.
Well, no, he said. I took his horse.
He swung his coat round my shoulders, put an arm round my waist, and led me down the main aisle of the stable block, past the loose boxes and stalls. Joshua had come in quietly through the other door, and was working at the far end of the stable, silhouetted against the light from the open double doors, as he pitchforked hay into the end stall. As we reached him, he glanced at us and nodded in greeting, his face carefully neutral at the sight of us, bedraggled, barefoot, and prickled with straw. Even in a household with a blind mistress, a slave knew what not to see. No business of his downcast countenance said clearly. He looked nearly as tired as I felt, eyes heavy and bloodshot.
How is he?
Jamie asked, lifting his chin toward the stall. Josh perked up a bit at the inquiry, putting down his pitchfork.
Oh, he's bonny, he said, with an air of satisfaction. A bonny lad, Mr. Wiley's Lucas. Indeed he is, Jamie agreed. Only he's mine now.
He's what?
Josh goggled at him, open-mouthed.
He's mine.
Jamie went to the railing and reached out a hand to scratch the ears of the big stallion busily engaged in eating hay from his manger.
Chase,
he murmured to the horse.
Il y vole.
I followed him, peering over his arm at the horse, who lifted his head for a moment, regarded us with a genial eye, snorted, tossed his veil-like mane out of his face, and went back to his breakfast with single-minded intent.
A lovely creature, is he, no?
Jamie was admiring Lucas, a look of distant speculation in his eyes.
Well, yes, he is, but...
My own admiration was substantially tinged with dismay. If Jamie had set out to avenge his own pride at the cost of Wiley's, he'd done it in spades. Despite my irritation with Wiley, I couldn't help a small pang at the thought of how he must be feeling at the loss of his magnificent Frisian.
But what's that, Mac?
Well, just...
I fumbled awkwardly for words.
I can scarcely say I felt sorry for Philip Wiley under the circumstances.
Just... Well, what do you mean to do with him?
Even I could see that Lucas was totally unsuited to life on Fraser's Ridge. The thought of ploughing or hauling with him seemed sacrilegious. And while I suppose Jamie could use him only for riding...
I frowned dubiously, envisioning the boggy bottoms and rocky trails that would threaten those well-turned legs and splinter the glossy hooves. the hanging boughs and undergrowth that would tangle in mane and tail. Gideon the man-eater was 1,000 times better suited to such rough environs.
"Oh, I didn't mean to keep him," Jamie assured me.
He looked at the horse and sighed regretfully.
"Though I should dearly love to. But you're right, he wouldn't do for the ridge. No, I mean to sell him."
"Oh, good." I was relieved to hear this. Wiley would undoubtedly buy Lucas back, no matter what the cost. I found that a comforting thought, and we could certainly use the money. Joshua had gone out while we were talking. At this point, he reappeared in the doorway, a sack of grain on his shoulder. His previous sluggish air had disappeared, though. His eyes were still bloodshot, but he looked alert and mildly alarmed.
"Mrs. Clare," he said, "begging your pardon, ma'am, but I met Teresa by the barn just now. She's saying as how there's summat gone amiss wi' Betty. I thought you'd maybe want to know."
Chapter 50. Blood in the Attic. The attic room looked like the scene of a murder, and a brutal one at that. Betty was struggling on the floor beside her overturned bed, knees drawn up and fists doubled into her abdomen, the muslin of her shift torn and saturated with blood. Fentiman was on the floor with her, dwarfed by her bulk, but vainly grappling with her spasming body, nearly as smeared with gore as she was. The sun was fully up now, and pouring in through the tiny windows in brilliant shafts that spotlighted parts of the chaos, leaving the rest in shadowed confusion. Cots were pushed aside and upset, bedding tangled in mounds, worn shoes and bits of clothing scattered like debris among the splotches of fresh blood on the wooden floor. I hurried across the attic, but before I could reach her, Betty gave a deep, gurgling cough, and more blood gushed from her mouth and nose. She curled forward, arched back, doubled hard again, and went limp. I fell to my knees beside her, though it was apparent from a glance that her limbs had relaxed into that final stillness from which there could be no hope of revival. I lifted her head and pressed my fingers under her jaw. Her eyes had rolled back, only the whites showing. No breath, no sign of a pulse in the clammy neck. From the quantities of blood spread round the room, I thought there could be very little left in her body. Her lips were blue, and her skin had gone the colour of ashes. Fentiman knelt behind her, wigless and white-faced, skinny arms still locked about her heavy torso, holding her slumped body half off the floor. He was in his nightshirt, I saw, a pair of blue satin breeches hastily pulled on beneath it. The air reeked of blood, bile and feces, and he was smeared with all those substances. He looked up at me, though he showed no sign of recognition, his eyes wide and blank with shock. "Dr. Fentiman?" I spoke softly. With the noise of struggle ceased, the attic was stricken with that absolute silence that often follows in the wake of death, and it seemed sacrilege to break it. He blinked, and his mouth worked a little, but he seemed to have no notion how to reply. He didn't move, though the spreading pool of blood had soaked through the knees of his breeches. I put a hand on his shoulder. It was bird bone, but rigid with denial. I knew the feeling. To lose a patient you have fought for is a terrible thing, and yet one all doctors know. "You've done all you can," I said, still softly, and tightened my grip. "It is not your fault." What had happened the day before wasn't important. He was a colleague, and I owed him what absolution lay in my power to give. He licked dry lips and nodded once, then bent to lay the body gently down. A shaft of light skimmed the top of his head, glowing through the scanty bristles of cropped grey hair, and making the bones of his skull seem thin and fragile. He seemed suddenly frail altogether, and let me help him to his feet without protest. A low moan made me turn, still holding his arm. A knot of female slaves huddled in the shadowed corner of the room, faces stark and dark hands fluttering with distress against the pale muslin of their shifts. There were male voices on the stair outside, muted and anxious. I could hear Jamie,
low-voiced and calm, explaining. "Gussie," I called to all the women in the corner with the first name that came to mind. The knot of slaves clung together for a moment, then reluctantly unravelled, and Gussie stepped out. A pale brown moth of a girl from Jamaica, small under a turban of blue calico. "Madam?" She kept her eyes on mine, steadfastly away from the still form on the floor. "I'm taking Dr. Fentiman downstairs. I'll have some of the men come to take care of Betty." "This?" I made a small gesture toward the mess on the floor, and she nodded, still shocked, but obviously relieved to have something to do. "Yes, madam. We do that quick." She hesitated, eyes darting round the room, then looked back at me. "Madam?"
"Yes?"
"Someone must go tell that girl named Fedra what's gone with Betty. You tell her, please." Startled, I looked and realised that Fedra wasn't among the slaves in the corner. Of course, as Jocasta's body servant, she would sleep downstairs, near her mistress, even on her wedding night. "Yes," I said uncertainly. "Of course, but..." "This Betty, that girl's mama," Gussie said, seeing my incomprehension. She swallowed, tears swimming in her soft brown eyes. "Somebody, can I go, madam? Can I go tell her?" "Please," I said, and stepped back, motioning her to go. She tiptoed past the body, then darted for the door, calloused bare feet thumping softly on the boards. Dr. Fentiman had begun to emerge from his shock. He pulled away from me and stooped toward the floor, making vague groping gestures. I saw that his medical kit had been upset in the struggle. Bottles and instruments were strewn across the floor in a litter of metal and broken glass. Before he could retrieve his kit, though, there was a brief commotion on the stairs, and Duncan came into the room, Jamie on his heels. I noticed with some interest that Duncan was still wearing his wedding clothes, though minus coat and waistcoat. Had he been to bed at all, I wondered. He nodded to me, but his eyes went at once to Betty, now sprawled on the floor, bloody shift crumpled round her broad, splayed thighs. One breast spilled from the torn fabric, heavy and slack as a half-filled pouch of meal. Duncan blinked several times. Then he wiped the back of his hand across his moustache and took a visible breath. He bent to pluck a quilt from the carnage and laid it gently over her.
"Help me with her, MacDhu," he said.
Seeing what he was about, Jamie knelt and gathered the dead woman up into his arms. Duncan drew himself upright and turned his face toward the women in the corner.
"Dinna fash yourselves," he said quietly. "I shall see her taken care of."
There was an unusual note of authority in his voice that made me realise that in spite of his natural modesty, he had accepted the fact that he was master here. The men left with their burden, and I heard Dr. Fentiman give a deep sigh. It felt as though the whole attic sighed with him. The atmosphere was still thick with stench and sorrow, but the shock of violent death was dissipating. "Leave it," I said to Fentiman, seeing him move again to pick up a bottle lying on the floor. "The women will take care of it." Not waiting for argument, I took him firmly by the elbow and marched him out the door and down the stair. People were up. I caught the sounds of rattling dishes from the dining room and the faint scent of sausages. I couldn't take him through the public rooms in his current state, nor up to the bedrooms. He was undoubtedly sharing a room with several other men, any of whom might still be abed. For lack of a better idea, I took him outside, pausing to snatch another of the maid's cloaks from the pegs by the door and wrap it round his shoulders. So Betty was, or had been, Fedra's mother. I hadn't known Betty well, but I did know Fedra, and felt grief for her tighten my throat. There was nothing I could do for her just now, though, but perhaps I could help the doctor. Silent with shock, he followed me obediently as I led him down the side path by the lawns, shielded from view by Hector Cameron's white marble mausoleum and its growth of ornamental yew bushes. There was a stone bench by the river, half hidden under a weeping willow. I doubted anyone would be patronising it at this hour of the morning. No one was, though two wine goblets sat on the bench, stained red with bee's wing, abandoned remnants of the night's festivities. I wondered briefly whether someone had been having a romantic rendezvous and was reminded suddenly of my own midnight tryst. Damn it, I still didn't know for sure who the owner of those hands had been. Pushing the nagging question away with the wine glasses, I sat down, gesturing to Dr. Fentiman to join me. It was chilly, but the bench was in full sun at this hour, and the heat was warm and comforting on my face. The doctor was looking better for the fresh air. Vestiges of colour had come back into his cheeks, and his nose had resumed its normal roseate hue. "Feeling a bit better, are you?" He nodded, hunching the cloak around his narrow shoulders.
"I am. I thank you, Mrs. Fraser."
"Rather a shock, wasn't it?" I asked, employing my most sympathetic bedside manner. He closed his eyes and shook his head briefly.
"Shocked? Yes, very shocked," he muttered. "I would never have..."
He trailed off, and I let him sit quiet for a moment. He would need to talk about it, but best to let him take it at his own pace. "It was good of you to come so quickly," I said, after a bit. "I see they called you from your bed. Had she grown suddenly worse, then?"
"Yes. I could have sworn she was on the mend last night, after I bled her."
He rubbed his face with both hands and emerged, blinking, eyes very bloodshot.
"The butler roused me just before dawn, and I found her once again complaining of griping in the guts. I bled her again, and then administered a clyster, but to no avail."
"A clyster?" I murmured. Clysters were enemas, a favourite remedy of the time. Some were fairly harmless, others were positively corrosive.
"A tincture of nicotiana," he explained, "which I find answers capitally in most cases of dyspepsia."
I made a non-committal noise in response.
Nicotiana was tobacco. I supposed a strong solution of that, administered rectally, would probably dispose promptly of a case of pinworms. But I didn't think it would do much for indigestion. Still, it wouldn't make anyone bleed like that either.
"Extraordinary amount of bleeding," I said, putting my elbows on my knees and resting my chin in my hands. "I don't think I've ever seen anything like it."
That was true.
I was curious, turning over various possibilities in my mind, but no diagnosis quite fit.
"No."
Dr. Fentiman's sallow cheeks began to show spots of red.
If I had thought..."
I leaned toward him and laid a consoling hand on his arm. "I'm sure you did all that anyone could possibly do," I said. "She wasn't bleeding at all from the mouth when you saw her last night, was she?" He shook his head, hunching deeper into his cloak.
"No. Still, I blame myself, I really do."
"One does," I said ruefully. "There's always that sense that one should have been able to do something more." He caught the depth of feeling in my voice and turned toward me, looking surprised.
The tension in him relaxed a little, and the red colour began to fade from his cheeks. "You have a most remarkably sympathetic understanding, Mrs. Fraser."
I smiled at him, not speaking.
He might be a quack. He might be ignorant, arrogant, and intemperate. But he had come at once when called, and had fought for his patient to the best of his ability. That made him a physician, in my book, and deserving of sympathy.
After a moment, he put his hand over mine.
We sat in silence, watching the river go by, dark brown and turbid with silt. The stone bench was cold under me, and the morning breeze kept sticking chilly fingers under my shift, but I was too preoccupied to take much note of such minor discomforts. I could smell the drying blood on his clothes, and saw again the scene in the attic. What on earth had the woman died of?
I prodded him gently, asking tactful questions, extracting what details he had gleaned, but they weren't helpful. He wasn't an observant man at the best of times, and it had been very early, and the attic dark.
He grew easier with the talking, though, gradually purging himself of that sense of personal failure that is the frequent price of a physician's caring.
"I hope Mrs. Cameron, Mrs. Innes, I mean, will not feel that I have betrayed her hospitality," he said uneasily. That seemed a rather odd way to put it.
On the other hand, Betty had been Jocasta's property. I suppose that beyond any sense of personal failure, Dr. Fentiman was also contemplating the possibility that Jocasta might blame him for not preventing Betty's death and try to claim recompense.
"I'm sure she'll realize that you did all you could," I said soothingly. "I'll tell her so if you like." "My dear lady," Dr. Fentiman squeezed my hand with gratitude, "you are as kind as you are lovely." "Do you think so, Doctor?"
A male voice spoke coldly behind me, and I jumped, dropping Dr. Fentiman's hand as though it were a high-voltage wire. I whirled on the bench to find Philip Wiley leaning against the trunk of the willow tree with a most sardonic expression on his face.
"Kind is not the word that springs most immediately to mind, I must say. Lewd, perhaps. Wanton, most certainly. But lovely? Yes, I'll give you that."
His eyes raked me from head to toe with an insolence that I would have found absolutely reprehensible had it not suddenly dawned on me that Dr. Fentiman and I had been sitting hand in hand in what could only be called a compromising state of déshabille, both still in our nightclothes. I stood up, drawing my dressing gown round me with great dignity. His eyes were fixed on my breasts. With a knowing expression? I wondered. I folded my arms under my breast, lifting my bosom defiantly.
"You forget yourself, Mr. Wiley," I said, as coldly as possible.
He laughed, but not as though he thought anything more funny.
"I forget myself. Have you not forgotten something, Mrs. Fraser? Such as your gown? Do you not find it a trifle cold, dressed like that? Or do the good doctor's embraces warm you sufficiently?"
Dr. Fentiman, as shocked as I was by Wiley's appearance, had got to his feet and now pushed his way in front of me, his thin cheeks mottled with fury.
"How dare you, sir? How do you have the infernal presumption to speak to a lady in such a fashion?"
"Were I armed, sir, I should call you out upon the instant. I swear it."
Wiley had been staring boldly at me. At this, his gaze shifted to Fentiman, and he saw the blood staining the doctor's legs and breeches. His hot-eyed scowl grew less certain.
"I... Has something happened, sir?"
"It is none of your concern, I assure you."
Fentiman bristled like a banty rooster, drawing himself upright. Rather grandly, he presented me with his arm.
"Come, Mrs. Fraser. You need not be exposed to the insulting jibes of this puppy."
He glared at Wiley, red-eyed.
"Allow me to escort you back to your husband."
Wiley's face underwent an instant transformation at the word puppy, turning a deep, ugly red. So early in the morning he was wearing neither paint nor powder, and the blotches of fury stood out like a rash on his fair skin. He seemed to swell noticeably, like an enraged frog. I had a sudden urge to laugh hysterically, but nobly suppressed it. Biting my lip instead, I accepted the doctor's proffered arm. He came up roughly to my shoulder, but pivoted on his bare heel and marched us away with all the dignity of a brigadier. Looking back over my shoulder, I saw Wiley still standing under the willow tree, staring after us. I lifted my hand and gave him a small wave of farewell. The light sparkled from my gold ring, and I saw him stiffen further.
"I do hope we'll be in time for breakfast," Dr. Fentiman said cheerfully. "I believe I have quite recovered my appetite."
Chapter 51. Suspicion. The guests began to depart after breakfast. Jocasta and Duncan stood together on the terrace, the very picture of a happily united couple, bidding everyone farewell as a line of carriages and wagons made its slow way down the drive. Those folk from downriver waited on the quay, the women exchanging last-minute recipes and bits of gossip, while the gentlemen lit pipes and scratched themselves, relieved of their uncomfortable clothes and formal wigs. Their servants, all looking considerably the worse for wear, sat open-mouthed and red-eyed on bundles of luggage.
"You look tired, Mama."
Bree looked rather tired herself. She and Roger had both been up till all hours. A faint smell of camphor wafted from her clothes.
"Can't imagine why," I replied, stifling a yawn.
"How's Jemmy this morning?" "He's got a sniffle," she said, "but no fever. He ate some porridge for breakfast and he's..."
I nodded, listened automatically, and went with her to examine Jemmy, who was cheerfully rambunctious, if runny-nosed, all in a slight daze of exhaustion. It reminded me of nothing so much as a sensation I had had now and then when flying from America to England. Jet lag, they called it, an odd feeling of being conscious and lucid, and yet not quite solidly fixed within one's body. The girl Gussie was watching Jemmy. She was as pale and bloodshot as everyone else on the premises, but I thought her air of dull suffering derived from emotional distress rather than hangover. All the slaves had been affected by Betty's death. They went about the chores of clearing up after the wedding festivities in near silence, their faces shadowed.
"Are you feeling all right?" I asked her, when I'd finished looking in Jemmy's ears and down his throat. She looked startled, then confused. I wondered whether anyone had ever asked her that before.
Oh, yes, madam, surely.
She smoothed down her apron with both hands, clearly nervous at my scrutiny. "All right, I'll just go and have a look at Phaedra, then." I'd come back to the house with Dr. Fentiman and turned him over to Ulysses to be fed and tidied up. I had then gone directly to find Phaedra, taking time only to wash and change my clothes, not wanting to come to her so visibly smeared with her mother's blood. I had found her in Ulysses' pantry, sitting numb and shocked on the stool where he sat to polish silver, a large glass of brandy by her side, undrunk. One of the other slaves, Teresa, was with her. She breathed a short sigh of relief at my appearance and came to greet me.
"She's none so weel," Teresa muttered to me, shaking her head with a wary glance back at her charge. "She's no said a word nor wept a drop."
Phaedra's beautiful face might have been carved of fruit wood. Normally a delicate cinnamon, her complexion had faded to a pale, ligneous brown, and her eyes stared fixedly through the open door of the pantry at the blank wall beyond. I put a hand on her shoulder. It was warm, but so motionless that she might have been a stone in the sun.
"I am sorry," I said to her softly. "Very sorry."
Dr. Fentiman came to her. He did all that he could.
That was true. No point in giving an opinion of Fentiman's skill. It was irrelevant now in any case.
No response. She was breathing. I could see the slight rise and fall of her bosom, but that was all. I bit the inside of my lower lip, trying to think of anything or anyone that might possibly give her comfort.
Jocasta?
Did Jocasta even know of Betty's death yet? Duncan knew, of course, but he might have chosen not to tell her until after the guests had left.
"The priest," I said, the idea occurring suddenly to me. "Would you like Father Leclerc to bless your mother's body?"
I thought it rather too late for last rites, assuming that Fed knew what those were, but I was sure that the priest wouldn't mind offering any comfort he could. He hadn't left yet. I'd seen him in the dining room only a few moments since, polishing off a platter of pork chops garnished with fried eggs and gravy. A slight tremor went through the shoulder under my hand. The still, beautiful face turned toward me, dark eyes opaque.
"What good will that do?"
she whispered.
Well.
Flustered, I groped for a reply, but she'd already turned away, staring at a stain in the wood of the table. What I had done in the end was to give her a small dose of laudanum, an irony I resolutely ignored, and tell Teresa to put her to bed on the cot where she normally slept, in the dressing room off Jocasta's boudoir. I pushed open the door of the dressing room now to see how she was. The small room was windowless and dark, smelling of starch and burnt hair, and the faint flower fragrance of Jocasta's toilet water. A huge armoire and its matching chiffonier stood at one side, a dressing table at the other.
A folding screen marked off the far corner, and behind this was Phaedra's narrow cot. I could hear her breathing, slow and deep, and felt reassured by that. I moved quietly through the dark room and pulled back the screen a little. She lay on her side, turned away, curled into a ball with her knees drawn up. Bree had come into the dressing room behind me. She looked over my shoulder, her breath warm on my ear. I made a small gesture indicating that everything was all right and pushed the screen back into place. Just inside the door to the boudoir, Brianna paused. She turned to me suddenly, put her arms about me, and hugged me fiercely. In the lighted room beyond, Jemmy missed her and began to shriek. Mama! Ma! Mama! I thought I ought to eat something, but with the smell of the attic and the scent of toilet water still lingering in the back of my sinuses, I had no appetite. A few guests still lingered in the dining room, particular friends of Jocasta's. They would be staying on for a day or two. I nodded and smiled as I passed, but ignored the invitations to come and join them, instead heading for the stairs to the second floor. The bedroom was empty, the mattresses stripped and the windows open to air the room. The hearth had been swept, and the room was cold but blessedly quiet. My own cloak still hung in the wardrobe. I lay down on the bare ticking, pulled the cloak over me, and fell instantly asleep. I woke just before sunset, starving, with an oddly mixed sense of reassurance and unease. The reassurance I understood at once. The scent of blood and flowers had been replaced by one of shaving soap and body-warmed linen, and the pale gold light streaming through the window shone on the pillow beside me, where a long, red-gold hair glinted in the hollow left by someone's head. Jamie had come and slept beside me. As though summoned by my thought, the door opened and he smiled in at me. Shaved, combed, freshly dressed and clear-eyed, he seemed to have erased all traces of the night before, bar the expression on his face when he looked at me. Frowsy and ill-kempt as I was by contrast with his own neat appearance, the look of tenderness in his eyes warmed me, in spite of the lingering chill in the room.
"Awake at last. Did you sleep well, Sassenach?"
"Like the dead," I replied automatically, and felt a small internal lurch as I said it. He saw it reflected on my face and came swiftly to sit down on the bed beside me.
"What is it? Have you had an evil dream, Sassenach?"
"Not exactly," I said slowly. "In fact, I had no memory of having dreamed at all. And yet my mind appeared to have been ticking away in the shadows of unconsciousness, making notes and drawing its deductions. Prompted now by the word dead, it had just presented me with its conclusions, which accounted for the feeling of unease with which I had awoken. That woman, Betty, have they buried her yet?"
"No. They've washed the body and put it in a shed. But Jocasta wished to wait until the morning for the burial so as not to trouble her guests. Some are staying on for another night."
He frowned slightly, watching me.
"Why?"
I rubbed a hand over my face, less to rouse myself than to collect my words. "There's something wrong. About her death, I mean."
"Wrong? How?"
One eyebrow lifted.
"It was a fearful way to die, to be sure. But that's not what you mean, is it?"
"No." My hands were cold. I reached automatically for his, and he took them, engulfing my fingers with warmth. "I mean, I don't believe it was a natural death. I think someone killed her." Blurted out that way, the words hung cold and stark in the air between us. His brows drew together, and he pursed his lips slightly, thinking. I noticed, though, that he didn't reject the idea out of hand, and that strengthened my conviction.
"Who?"
he asked at last.
"And are you sure of it, Sassenach?"
"I've no idea. And I can't be totally sure," I admitted. "It's only..." I hesitated, but he squeezed one of my hands lightly in encouragement. I shook my head. "I've been a nurse, a doctor,
a healer for a long time, Jamie. I've seen a dreadful number of people die, and from all sorts of things. I can't quite put into words what it is here. But now that I've slept on it, I just know, I think, it's wrong, I ended, rather lamely. The light was fading. Shadows were coming down from the corners of the room, and I shivered suddenly, gripping his hands.
I see, he said softly. But there's no way you can tell for sure, is there?
The window was still half open. The curtains billowed suddenly into the room with a gust of wind, and I felt the hairs rise on my arms with cold.
There might be, I said.
This ends Disc 24 of The Fiery Cross. The story continues on Disc 25. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader. Recorded Books presents The Fiery Cross, Disc 25.
Chapter 52. A Hard Day's Night. The outbuilding where they had put the body was well away from the house, a small tool shed outside the kitchen garden. The waning moon was low in the sky, but still shed light enough to see the brick path through the garden. The espaliered fruit trees spread black as spiderwebs against the walls. Someone had been digging. I could smell the cold damp of recently turned earth, and shivered involuntarily at the hint of worms and mould.
Jamie felt it, and put a light hand on my back.
All right, Sassenach, he whispered.
Yes.
I gripped his free hand for reassurance.
They would hardly be burying Betty in the kitchen garden. The digging must be for something prosaic, like an onion bed or a trench for early peas.
The thought was comforting, though my skin still felt cold and thin, prickling with apprehensions. Jamie himself was far from easy, though he was outwardly composed as usual. He was no stranger to death and had no great fear of it. But he was both Catholic and Celt, with a strong conviction of another unseen world that lay past the dissolution of the body. He believed implicitly in spirits and had no desire to meet one. Still, if I was determined, he would brave the other world for my sake. He squeezed my hand hard and didn't let go. I squeezed back, deeply grateful for his presence. Beyond the debatable question of how Betty's ghost might feel about my proposed plan of action, I knew that the notion of deliberate mutilation disturbed him deeply, however much his own intelligence might be convinced that a soulless body was no more than clay.
To see men hacked to death on a battlefield is one thing, he'd said earlier in the evening, still arguing with me. Well, that's war. And it's honourable, cruel as it may be. But to take a blade and carve up a poor innocent like yon woman in cold blood.
He looked at me, eyes dark with troubled thought.
You're sure you must do it, Claire?
Yes, I am, I had said, eyes fixed on the contents of the bag I was assembling. A large roll of lint wadding to soak up fluids, small jars for organ samples, my largest bone saw, a couple of scalpels, a wicked pair of heavy-bladed shears, a sharp knife borrowed from the kitchen. It was a sinister-looking collection, to be sure. I wrapped the shears in a towel to prevent them clanking against the other implements, and put them in the bag, carefully marshalling my words.
Look, I said at last, raising my eyes to meet his.
There's something wrong, I know it. And if Betty was killed, then surely we owe it to her to find that out.
If you were murdered, wouldn't you want someone to do whatever they could to prove it? To avenge you?
He stood still for a long moment, eyes narrowed in thought as he looked down at me.
Then his face relaxed, and he nodded. Aye, I would, he said quietly.
He picked up the bone saw and began wrapping it with cloth. He hadn't protested further. He hadn't asked me again whether I was sure. He had merely said firmly that if I was going to do it, he was coming with me, and that was all about it.
As for being sure, I wasn't. I did have an abiding feeling that something was very wrong about this death, but I was less confident in my sense of what it was.
with the cold moon sinking through an empty sky and wind brushing my cheeks with a touch of icy fingers. Betty might have died only by accident, not malice. I could be wrong. Perhaps it was a simple hemorrhage of an esophageal ulcer, the bursting of an aneurysm in the throat, or some other physiological oddity. Unusual, but natural. Was I doing this, in fact, only to try to vindicate my faith in my own powers of diagnosis? The wind belled my cloak, and I pulled it tighter around me, one-handed, stiffening my spine. No, it wasn't a natural death. I knew it. I couldn't have said how I knew it, but fortunately, Jamie hadn't asked me that. I had a brief flash of memory. Joe Abernathy, a jovial smile of challenge on his face, reaching into a cardboard box full of bones, saying, "I just want to see, can you do it to a dead person, Lady Jane?" I could. I had. He had handed me a skull, and the memory of Gilles Duncan shuddered through me like liquid ice.
"You needn't do it, Claire."
Jamie's hand tightened on mine.
"I will not think you a coward."
His voice was soft and serious, barely audible above the wind. "I would," I said, and felt him nod. That was the matter settled then. He let go of my hand and went ahead of me to open the gate. He paused, and my dark-adapted eyes caught the clean, sharp line of his profile as he turned his head, listening. The dark lantern he carried smelled hot and oily, and a faint gleam escaping from its pierced work panel sprinkled the cloth of his cloak with tiny flecks of dim light. I glanced round myself and looked back at the house. Late as it was, candles still burned in the back parlour where the card games lingered on. I caught a faint murmur of voices as the wind changed, and a sudden laugh. The upper floors were mostly dark, save one window which I recognised as Jocasta's. "Your aunt's awake late," I whispered to Jamie. He turned and looked up at the house.
"Nay, as Duncan," he said softly.
"My aunt doesn't need the light after all." "Perhaps he's reading to her in bed," I suggested, trying to leaven the solemnity of our errand. A small derisive huff came from Jamie, but the oppressive atmosphere did lift just a bit. He unlatched the gate and pushed it open, showing a square of utter black beyond. I turned my back on the friendly lights of the house and stepped through, feeling just a bit like Persephone entering the underworld. Jamie swung the gate to and handed me the lantern. "What are you doing?" I whispered, hearing the rustle of his clothing. It was so dark by the gate that I couldn't see him as more than a dark blur, but the faint sound that came next told me what he was doing. "Pissing on the gateposts," he whispered back, stepping back and rustling further as he did up his breeks. "If we must, then we will. But I didn't want anything to be following us back to the house." I made my own small huffing noise at that, but made no demur when he insisted upon repeating this ritual at the door to the shed. Imagination or not, the night seemed somehow inhabited, as though invisible things moved through the darkness, murmuring under the voice of the wind. It was almost a relief to go inside, where the air was still, even though the sense of death mingled thickly with the dankness of rust, rotted straw, and mildewed wood. There was a faint rasp of metal as the dark lantern's panel slid back, and a dazzling shaft of light fell over the confines of the shed. They had laid the dead slave on a board across two trestles, already washed and properly laid out, wrapped in a rough muslin shroud. Beside her stood a small loaf of bread and a cup of brandy. A small posy of dried herbs, carefully twisted into a knot, lay on the shroud just above the heart. Who had left those, I wondered. One of the other slaves, surely. Jamie crossed himself at the sight and looked at me, almost accusingly.
"It's ill luck to touch grave goods."
"I'm sure it's only ill luck to take them," I assured him, low-voiced. Though I crossed myself before taking the objects and putting them on the ground in a corner of the shed.
I'll put them back when I've finished.
Mm-hmm. Wait just a moment, Sassenach. Dinna touch her yet.
He dug in the recesses of his cloak and emerged with a tiny bottle. He uncorked this and, putting his fingers to the opening, poured out a little liquid which he flicked over the corpse, murmuring a quick Gaelic prayer that I recognised as an invocation to St. Michael to protect us from demons, ghouls, and things that go bump in the night. Very useful.
Is that holy water?
I asked, incredulous.
Aye, of course. I got it from Father Leclerc.
He made the sign of the cross over the body and laid his hand briefly on the draped curve of the head before nodding reluctant approval for me to proceed. I extracted a scalpel from my bag and slit the stitching on the shroud carefully. I'd brought a stout needle and waxed thread to sew up the body cavity. With luck, I could also repair the shroud sufficiently that no one would realise what I'd been doing. Her face was almost unrecognisable, round cheeks gone slack and sunken, and the soft bloom of her black skin faded to an ashy grey, the lips and ears a livid purple. That made it easier. It was clear that this was indeed only a shell, and not the woman I had seen before. That woman, if she was still in the vicinity, would have no objections, I thought. Jamie made the sign of the cross again and said something soft in Gaelic, then stood still, the lantern held high so that I could work by its light. The light threw his shadow on the wall of the shed, gigantic and eerie in the wavering flicker. I looked away from it, down to my work. The most formal and sanitary of modern autopsies is simple butchery. This was no better, and worse only in the lack of light, water, and specialised tools. "You needn't watch, Jamie," I said, standing back for a moment to wipe a wrist across my brow. Cold as it was in the shed, I was sweating from the heavy work of splitting the breastbone, and the air was thick with the ripe smells of an open body. "There's a nail on the wall. You could hang up the lantern if you want to go out for a bit."
"I'm all right, Sassenach."
"What's that?" He leaned forward, pointing carefully. The look of disquiet on his features had been replaced by one of interest.
"The trachea and bronchi," I replied, "tracing the graceful rings of cartilage. And a bit of a lung.
If you're all right, then can I have the light a little closer here, please?" Lacking spreaders, I couldn't wrench the rib cage far enough apart to expose the complete lung on either side, but thought I could see enough to eliminate some possibilities. The surfaces of both lungs were black and grainy. Betty was in her 40s and had lived all her life with open wood fires. "Anything nasty that you breathe in and don't cough up again, tobacco, smoke, soot, smog and what have you, gradually gets shoved out between the lung tissue and the pleura," I explained, lifting a bit of the thin, half-transparent pleural membrane with the tip of my scalpel. "But the body can't get rid of it altogether, so it just stays there. A child's lung would be a nice clean pink."
"Do mine look like that?"
Jamie stifled a small, reflexive cough.
"And what is smog?"
"The air in cities like Edinburgh, where you get smoke mixing with fog off the water." I spoke abstractedly, grunting slightly as I pulled the ribs back, peering into the shadowed cavity. "Yours likely aren't so bad, since you've lived out of doors or in unheated places so much. Clean lungs are one compensation to living without fire."
"That's good to know, if you've got no choice about it," he said. "Given the choice, I expect most folk would rather be warm and cough."
I didn't look up, but smiled, slicing through the upper lobe of the right lung.
"They would. And they do."
No indication of hemorrhage in either lung, no blood in the airway, no evidence of pulmonary embolism. No pooling of blood in the chest or abdominal cavity either, though I was getting some seepage. Blood will clot soon after death, but then gradually reliquefies.
"Hand me a bit more of the wadding, will you please?"
A little spotting of blood on the shroud likely wouldn't worry anyone, given the spectacular nature of Betty's demise, but I didn't want enough to make anyone sufficiently suspicious to check inside. I leaned across to take the lint from his hand, inadvertently putting a hand on the corpse's side. The body emitted a low groan, and Jamie leapt back with a startled exclamation, the light swinging wildly. I had jumped.